Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. John Hancock filling in. We've been talking about it, led the show off in the 3 o'clock hour, talking about this redistricting challenge that's happening in Texas and potentially other states as well. And of course, the issue of gerrymandering came up, and I have never seen, and I've been looking at congressional maps, sad to say, almost my entire life. I've never seen a state more gerrymandered than the state of Illinois, and joining us here to talk about it is State Representative from Illinois, District 116. It's got parts of the Metro East, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about his governor, who the governor of Indiana had this to say about J.B. Pritzker.
All I can tell you is individuals living in Illinois, especially the Chicago area, have been migrating into Indiana. Mm-hmm. And if J.B. Pritzker thinks that he is going to be material to be president from that hard progressive lean, I don't think that's going to work.
That was Governor Mike Braun of Indiana. And joining us now, State Representative David Freese from Illinois. And David, welcome aboard to the Mark Reardon Show. And thanks again for that triple in the ninth inning of game six and the home run in the 11th inning. That was something.
It was. I'm glad I could contribute. I really appreciate the accolades there. So, hey, one quick correction, John, and I appreciate you having me on. Because of the new map, it's the 115th now. It was the 116th.
Ah, gotcha.
They remapped me and they renumbered me. So, yeah.
All right, gotcha. And if you're listening out there on the roads, this is not the actual David Freese who hit the home run and the triple in the World Series of 2011, but it is the state representative from the 115th District. Let's start with your map, because I've never seen the congressional map. I've not looked at the state legislative maps in Illinois. I assume they're as bad. But
oh, they are.
How bad is it?
It's the worst. There's entities out there that grade the how bad states are gerrymandered, the district are gerrymandered. And Illinois, as you can imagine, gets a big fat F for that because it's absolutely ridiculous. They, the Democrats in control, they dilute every Republican vote that they can, which is sort of kind of comical seeing our governor now running around like his hair is on fire, complaining about what Texas is doing because the Illinois General Assembly did it to us in Illinois.
Yeah, he's basically saying that they're cheating in Texas, and we cheated fair and square here in Illinois. That's what he's basically saying.
It is comical. It really is.
So there's speculation that if Texas proceeds and they redraw their map, that other states, California, New York, potentially Illinois, would follow suit. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, could that congressional map in Illinois get even worse?
Man, I don't know how. I really don't, because I was actually there. It was my first term when we went through this most recent map, and they were dropping what we call dropping potential maps periodically. And what they would do is they would draw Republican legislators together just to see if we would get in a little heated discussion and bad mouth the other person. It was really sad and childish. Now, personally, I think it needs to be done by an outside agency.
Mm-hmm.
Get the politics out of it, because if you look at ours, our maps in the state of Illinois, they clearly take in certain neighborhoods, certain communities, and they draw around people's houses. When Senator Lutterfeld was in the Senate, I think they actually drew him out of his district because of his influence.
Yeah, it's really something else. And you living in that state, looks like you're going to have a presidential candidate coming from your state, talking about Governor J.B. Pritzker.
God help us.
Yeah. What's it been like to serve under his governorship?
It's odd and unique because the woke agenda that the Democrats push, I mean, he is front and center in all of it. Higher taxes. A couple of things what they're discussing here in Illinois is a package tax. So if an Amazon package gets delivered to your door, it's going to be $1.50. They're talking about service taxes. I mean, anything that they can tax, they do because they can't stop spending money. It's absolutely crazy. And then, you know, you want to take in the transgender stuff too. Again, he is front and center with all of the crazy wokeness.
You know, and it's clear that that's the lane he's going to try and take in the presidential campaign. And, you know, as a Republican, I hope they nominate somebody that's that far out of touch with, because that's all that woke stuff is not a small reason why Donald Trump won the last election.
And without a doubt. Yes.
And so, you know, I don't think the powers that be in the Democratic Party are going to want to nominate somebody like J.B. Pritzker, but they might. And one thing that frustrated me, he knows he's running for president. That's a full-time process. And yet he took the selfish step of announcing that he's running for re-election as governor next year, when his campaign for president will be taking off and he'll be traveling and full-time and out of the state. And I don't, you know, I think it's really selfish of him to try and do both of those things. How does that sitting with the General Assembly?
Well, it's hard to say right now with the General Assembly, because we're out of session.
Right.
And everybody knows that he's running. So, I communicate with some of the other legislators, but it'll be curious to see when we get back in Springfield for what they call veto session in October, what the thought process is on that. But it's very clear that he is already running for president, because he's going to different states, different Democrat conventions, and he's getting his face in front of the camera. He's getting on stage. He's talking to as many people as he can. So everybody knows he's running. I don't know why he doesn't admit it. I don't know why he doesn't, not run for governor, because again, we as citizens of the state of Illinois, we're going to get short shrift, because he's not going to be here. Like you said, he's going to be out on the campaign trail.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, I don't know the particular dynamics between Pritzker and the lawmakers, but I know in a lot of places there's just a natural tension between the governor and the legislative branch. How does he get along with the Democrats in the Illinois House and Senate?
Well, because most of our elected Democrats are what I would consider far left.
Yeah.
They're with the exception of a handful, I mean, they're in lockstep. They really are. I mentioned the package tax. That didn't go through. I think only because there were a handful of Democrats that were really concerned about raising taxes at this point in time, because, you know, we've got primaries coming up here shortly.
Yeah.
And then they're going to run for reelection. So they were not going to be put on for voting for another tax, especially for those in Chicago, where they're really hurting. They need property tax relief like nobody's business.
You guys have how many congressional seats in Illinois?
We got 118.
I'm sorry, congressional.
State. Oh, congressional? Oh, yeah. I didn't know this was going to be a pop quiz.
That's all right. But you got a lot of them. And you're one of the larger states in the country, and then obviously the population centers around the Chicagoland area. In the legislature, when you get downstate, are there many, if any, Democrats elected to the General Assembly?
So we have two in what we would consider the Metro East. Mm-hmm. on the House side. We got a senator down here as well. And obviously that's a Metro East, where you got a Democrat concentration in St. Clair County.
Right.
But outside of that, no, you're not going to find a Democrat down here.
Yeah, and you get into Madison. Madison County used to be kind of swingy years ago, and the Democrats would win and some. But now Madison County is just rock solid conservative. I don't think there's a Democrat in the county courthouse, is there?
I know. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
It is.
Oh, God.
It's remarkable.
Yes.
So what do you place the odds of Pritzker calling what would have to be, I would think, a special session to and task you guys with redrawing the congressional boundaries? Do you think that's likely?
No. No. Because nobody wants to be in Springfield if they don't have to. I mean, they don't. And here's the thing. So I got a day job. I work for a living. You know, it was really considered a part-time job. So So I'm not the only one. Now, I don't know how many Democrats have a job outside of being a state legislator, but they don't want to be there for this. And honestly, I don't know what else they would do to make the maps more favorable for them. I mean, that's the crazy thing about it is, Pritzker campaigned, said, I'm not going to, vote for a gerrymandered map. And that's exactly what he did, So I don't know what he would do or what the legislator would do to make it worse than it already is.
It's the worst I've ever seen. He is State Representative David Freese. He's from the 115th District over in Metro East. David, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
John, I appreciate you having me on.
You bet. So there you have it, folks. He, at least for one, doesn't think Pritzker's going to try and redraw that crazy Illinois map, and it is a crazy, crazy map. As I say, the worst I've ever seen. He makes a great point. I don't know how you could make it any worse than what they've already done over. They got that one district. It's like a worm, and it goes from southern Illinois all the way up to close to Chicago area. I mean, it's crazy.
That's insane. I like this idea of having somebody from the outside do this. Why don't you have a rational person, an outside party, come in and say, here's how you draw a map, the end?
Well, and, if you did that, you could very well get more competitive elections.
Mm-hmm.
And the dirty little secret about American politics today is that when we all show up in November to go vote, 80% of the elections are decided before a single vote is cast, because whatever party has the majority and whoever wins the primary is going to be the elected official.
Right.
So 80% of the elected officials in this country are effectively elected to the office in primary elections, where maybe 35% of the people vote, and that's split between, 18% Democrat and 17% Republican, or vice versa. So a sliver of less than 20% of the voters are picking the office holders for all of us. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And if you had a map drawing process for congressional seats that kind of looked at communities of interest and drew them to be contiguous and compact.
Right.
More of those seats would be competitive in November, and that would change, we're really in a kind of a sick little place right now where, because let's just take any office. Let's just take mayor of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats gonna win.
Yes.
And so, or in St. Louis County, the county executive. The last time we've had a Republican county executive elected in St. Louis County was 1986.
That's nuts.
So chances are the winner of the Democrat primary is going to win. And what you're seeing in these primaries then, where you know that the winner is going to be the presumptive elected official, you're seeing more and more candidates get into the primaries. So now you've got a 4-5-6-way primary, so that the winner of that primary is going to get a sliver of a percentage of 16% of the population voting for them. Well, and a great example I cite all the time, we had a 4-way primary for governor in 2016, Republicans. And Republicans were going to win the governor's race because Missouri's now a reliably red state. And the guy who won that primary, Eric Greitens, got just over 30% of the vote. He was selected by 6%. Of registered voters in Missouri, and by virtue of that, he became the governor.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just kind of the way it works. Well, I've got some thoughts on our next topic. I think Ethan may have a thought or two as well. I know he does a lot of work on Cardinal baseball. The Cardinals exited the trade deadline. They took a series from the Dodgers, second time this year. But I'm a little concerned about where this is all headed, and if you don't mind, sir, we'll break it down.
Let's talk about it.
All right. That's Ethan. I'm John. And for Mark, he's back tomorrow right here on 97.1 FM Talk. Hi there. Ho there. It's the Mark Reardon Show. John Hancock sitting in. Mark is back tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll be, as I am, very happy to hear that news. Sitting here with Ethan Hannaford, who's been running the board for me today and doing a spectacular job. And I know you're a baseball guy, Ethan. You got your Cardinal hat on over there. And
I do.
Baseball guy. Mm-hmm. As well, and I've got some real concerns about this ball club.
Talk to me.
This year was over. They teased us a little bit early on, didn't they? And
they did.
But they came time to the trade deadline, and the bottom line, we just didn't have the starting pitching. Bullpen was great, but we just didn't have the starting pitching to sustain a full season like that. And once those warts became apparent. The Cardinals started losing, and then they dealt off the entire back end almost of their bullpen at the trade deadline at the end of July. So here we are, and we're going to get through the season. They did make some trades. They did get some young prospects, really young prospects. Mm-hmm. Couple of guys that are able to be in AAA that might be somewhat close, both position players. And a lot of young talent, a lot of young arms, but guys that are going to be years away from getting to the big league club. And if you look at AAA, there was a lot of excitement last season about Quinn Matthews. He's really had a step back this year. He's got some control issues. Tink Hintz is another guy that's had some control issues and some injury issues. I guess he did make a start the other night for AAA Memphis. And then the guy that I think most people were enthusiastic about was the pitcher, help me.
Tekoa Robey.
And he's having Tommy John surgery. Mm-hmm. So he's out of contention for next year. Meanwhile, Miles Michaelis is not going to have his contract renegotiated here. He's done. Mm-hmm. And Michael McGreevy, a nice piece, but he's probably a number four starter in a five-man rotation. Sonny Gray's a year older next year. A lot of excitement about Matthew Liberatore, and rightfully so. But I don't know. And the Cardinals have this glut on the infield and the outfield that they didn't address at the trade deadline. So it just seems to me, Ethan, that they are years away, 2, 3, maybe 4 years away from being a serious contender, because I don't know how you go find good, high-quality starting pitching in an offseason. And the free agent list, I don't think, is great in that regard. And the teams don't trade number one starters.
Well, here's the thing, and you are right in the sense that this is not going to be a quick fix. This is going to take some time. Chaim Bloom is inheriting a mess.
Yeah.
This is not like, 2008 when John Mozeliak inherited the system that Walt Jocketty had built. This is not that. This is going to take some time to shuffle through. Unfortunately, because of a lot of the injuries, as you just had mentioned, that the prospect field has experienced, it is going to take that. That is a setback. And you didn't even mention Cooper Jerpy, who was their 2022 first round pick. Sam Roberson, a guy that they brought in at the trade deadline the last time that they had sold in 2023, he's done for the year. So there's a lot of injuries, and to a certain extent that does push you back, because we know based off of this year that the Cardinals did take a step back as far as spending goes. They know that if they are going to compete with the big dogs, the majority of it is going to have to come from homegrown talent, and right now their development system is just not there. So they acknowledged it finally last offseason.
They did.
Chaim Bloom is running all of that this year, and he's going to continue to be the head of that, which encourages you some, right? The reason that they took money out of the on-field product this year is because they put a lot more into the developmental part of the things. So you hope that things continue to move in the right direction. As you mentioned, of the six prospects they acquired at the trade deadline, four of them go to high A, which means, yes, they are going to take a little while. It's a step in the right direction as far as,
long-term.
Recognizing, yes, it's going to take some time to build that process up. I don't know if I would say necessarily it's 3 or 4 years away, and here's why. Chaim Bloom has to be active in this offseason. It's not going to be an offseason to sit on your hands, right? I mean, you have guys that you have to really decide, okay, you're either going to extend them or you're going to need to trade them, because then you're wasting what their value is right now.
Yeah, and too many left-handed bats in the lineup.
You have a lot of surplus, a lot of redundancy, and I'm going to be interested to see what exactly the market demand for some of that redundancy is. What are teams looking at Lars Nootbaar saying? What are they looking at Nolan Gorman? Some of these guys like that. And I'm not saying you're going to get a number one starter at this point for one of those individually, but if you can find some young controllable pitching that you feel like you can build upon and get yourself a heart of the rotation guy, I think that sets you up for success down the road. And if you can get eventually these pieces that you can lean on developing right, then eventually then the Cardinals can get back into spending and bring in that higher end guy.
Yeah, but you got to be right. The Cardinals, to acquire bats in recent years, have traded Zach Gallen. They've traded Sandy Alcantara. We've had pitching talent in the system.
Mm-hmm.
But it just hasn't made it. And when you go now trading, because you got this bundle of players that would include probably Nootbaar, Donovan, Gorman,
Burleson, Walker.
Yeah.
If you're looking at lefties, then yeah. Walker. But
yeah,
redundancy, right?
Some of those guys, at least a couple of those guys, probably aren't on this team on opening day.
I would assume
next year.
Yeah, I would assume
And what can you get for them? I got to believe that. The younger guys. I tell you, a guy that would have some trade value, but I don't think you're going to trade him, is Ivan Herrera. He's a powerful right-handed bat.
It depends how close the Cardinals think they are.
Yeah,
because if they think that they're a year or two away and that they can get this thing moving, then he's a guy that you build around. But if you feel like this is, they have a much better, deeper look into the system. If they feel like it's going to take longer than that, then yeah, this is the time to probably maximize on the value of a guy like Ivan Herrera.
And Donovan, if you think you're 3 or 4 years out, he's going to be 30, right?
Exactly. He's 28 now, I think.
That's a guy that, as much as I love him, he's a great ball player. He's a Cardinal. I mean, the guy plays the game like the Cardinals play
the game. Absolutely.
But he's a guy that would have some value now, and by the time the Cardinals are really competitive again, he might be a little long in the tooth. So you'd have to look at offers there, because I would think he would command a pretty good return.
I completely agree. Right, and that's why he's one of the guys. He's the main guy I think you look at. If you're not extending him now, then you have to maximize on the value. He's coming off of an all-star caliber season. I know he's cooled off here of recent, the last month or so. But this is a guy that is a huge clubhouse piece, can play multiple spots on the diamond. It's just, he's a winner. He goes out there, and this is the kind of guy that you build around. And there would definitely be some interest around the league for him.
The Cubs are in town starting tomorrow night. And it's always fun, no matter what the records are. And we'll see how the rest of this season plays out when we come back. Former St. Louis County Police Chief Tim Fitch is going to join us, kind of talk about juvenile crime and what's happening out there. And our cut of the day in the final segment is on that very same topic. It's the Mark Reardon Show right here on 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome aboard. It's the Mark Reardon Show. Mark is back on Friday tomorrow, and everybody's happy about that. This is John Hancock filling in. And one of the things that we've noticed, and we just had a news conference today that's going to be our cut of the day in the next segment, from Jeanine Pirro, who is the now confirmed U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, talking about juvenile crime, and who better to help us understand what's happening out there on the streets than the former St. Louis County Police Chief. He's also a former St. Louis County Councilman. Our good friend Tim Fitch, who is going to be on the roundtable in the 3 o'clock hour with Mark Reardon tomorrow. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing great, John. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to having Mark back. And so from your perspective, how big of a problem is juvenile crime in the overall, I'm talking about crimes of violence primarily, is it about the same as it was a decade or two ago? Is it getting worse? Does it make up a disproportionate share of the actual criminal activity?
It definitely makes up a disproportional share. If you just look at crimes committed for those under 25, that's the biggest segment of offenders. We talk often about, clearing out prisons and letting people go. And if you really want to make an impact on prison population, you let the older crowd go, 45 and up. Typically they represent quite a few that are in jail, but they don't repeat offend like juveniles do. Juveniles just aren't at that maturity level, and they have a lot of peer pressure that gets them involved in these things. But what I'm telling you that I'm seeing still is that juveniles, these crimes are getting younger and younger and younger. It's amazing the youth of some of these violent offenders. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, but it's not getting any better.
Because you're seeing now very violent crimes being committed by 13 and 14-year-old kids. And they of course go to the juvenile justice system where, there's not really held to account for what they have done. It's not an easy thing to adjudicate a juvenile as an adult. It's done, but it's not a simple process to do that. And one of the things that I wonder about, and I, maybe you know the answer to this, how much of the juvenile, I'm talking about the under 18 crime, is gang related?
Well, there's certainly some of that, and they're easily influenced, and gangs kind of replace, you know, parental, that you usually see parental supervision. The gangs kind of do that, except their supervision is a little different. They basically insist on them getting involved in crimes at younger and younger ages. And these older youth, you know, the ones that are 17, 18, 19, they'll actually enlist these younger people because they know if they get caught, they're juveniles. So very little is going to be done to them. So you see a lot of that as well. But as far as gangs go, yeah, certainly. We have gangs in the St. Louis area and have as long as I've been in law enforcement. I don't think they have any more influence than they ever have had. But what we are seeing is a whole lot less of parental supervision of these young people because many of the parents aren't a whole lot older than the kids. And, you know, they had their issues when they were kids, and they just kind of let the kids do whatever they want to do. You know, why are they out at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning? Why doesn't the parent know that they're out at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning? That's the interesting part. You start to see states starting to criminalize some of the actions of the adults, the parents, that their children commit.
I was going to ask that, Tim and Sue. I mean, how do you battle that, right? If they're sending out more kids, the older kids know that the younger kids are too young to get actually punished for it, and the parents don't care, what do you do?
Well, like I said, I think it's going to be remains to be seen if it's successful. These states that are now charging the parents with the crimes that the kids are committing. Typically, you know, we've seen this in the city of St. Louis on the 4th of July, where they charge the parents with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. By the way, all these charges, for the most part, we're talking about, and I know what the attorney, U.S. attorney said in D.C., but it's rare the feds ever get involved in juvenile crime. It's rare because, you know, the feds typically will allow juvenile crime to be prosecuted in the state system. So I'm not sure exactly what the feds are going to do about the juvenile crime in D.C.
If the parents don't care that the kids are out and about, are they going to care that they get charged?
Typically not. And a lot of times you find out these parents, a lot of them have records themselves. So it's not terribly unusual. And if they get charged with a, you know, crime like contributing, it's probably not that big of a deal to them. And then what do you do? Do you take the parent and put them in jail? Then who's going to watch the kids?
Exactly.
The state?
Oh.
It's a terrible cycle.
How thoroughly do our local police understand precisely who the problems are in these communities? But, you know, by name, you keep an eye on that kid because he's, you know, do you have a pretty good sense of who the likely committing crimes are?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ask any beat officer in any jurisdiction, whether it be the city or one of the municipalities or the county police, who's the troublemakers in your sector, in your beat. And they will know exactly who that handful, who they are, where they're at. Are they in? Are they out? Who do they hang with? What kind of vehicles are they usually found in? What kind of crimes they like to commit? Cops are very good at knowing that in their beats.
And it is a handful, right? I mean, we're not talking about just rampant everybody's a crook.
That's right. It's the same ones over and over for the most part. That's why they know them. You know, you know, you'd ask any officer, you know, hey, we had 3 cars broken into on the street last night, and they'll say it was probably this guy or that guy. It'd be very narrow.
Wow. Well, I mean, I guess that's encouraging to know. And so much of that kind of property crime is being committed by juveniles. So there you have it. Hey, I wanted to get your thoughts. We talked to Steve Ellman today about this new regional police training facility. Is that something that excites you as a former police chief?
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen some of the plans. I understand what it's all about, how it's going to be funded. It's going to be a game changer for law enforcement in the St. Louis metro area. The only thing that still stuns me is the city of St. Louis Police Department is not involved, that they have not gotten involved in this. And I was hoping maybe the new mayor would jump on board. But when I went to the police academy way back in 1983, I went to the academy in the city of St. Louis, you know, on Clark Street. That's where everybody went to the academy. The county police, the municipal officers, and the city police all went to the academy. And then it was moved out to Wellston, where the current county academy is. And it's old as well. So this new academy is going to be state of the art. It's going to be very proud facility for any police officer to graduate from or attend in-service training.
Hey, Tim, we were asking Steve Ellman about that, and I was like, is the city going to get in on this? And he said he does have some hope that that will happen. But, you know, it just seems weird and nebulous to me. She should just say, yes, we want in the end. Why do we have to float around? It drives me crazy.
Well, you know, we tried to get the city police involved in the New County Academy, then New County Academy, yeah, when it opened in Wellston. And they said, nope, can't do it. It's not in the city of St. Louis, so we will not participate. And if you know where the academy is, it's like a half mile from the city boundary. Said, nope, it's got to be in the city. I don't know if it's that mentality going on with the city police or a nobody could teach us law enforcement. We want to teach our own people law enforcement. Well, I hate to say this, but the POST Commission, that's the licensing for the state of Missouri, they tell you what training you have to have. Now, you can add a lot more training, but I will tell you that city police officers and county police officers and municipal officers are all trained pretty much the same way, because that's what state law requires.
I see. Well, we were happy to hear today that somebody is going to run against Sam Page.
Yes. Senator Brian Williams, who's been actually talking about doing this for probably nearly a year now. I personally talked with him about it at one point where he was undecided. His question to me was, well, are you going to run? And my answer was absolutely not. But I will tell you, in interest of full disclosure, I'm the treasurer for Dennis Hancock's campaign for county executive, the Republican candidate who's currently serving in my old seat in the 3rd District on the county council. So I suspect Brian Williams is going to have a pretty easy time beating Sam Page, because the issue with Sam Page right now that he's under indictment is he can't raise money. He's not able to raise any money. That's the issue. Whether or not he gets convicted or not, not many people are going to donate to a local candidate who's under indictment. So they will look for alternatives. And now that Brian Williams, I think, has popped up a little earlier than he wanted to, we'll probably start taking all of those campaign dollars from Sam Page.
Well, you worked with Sam Page for a number of years. Just by observation, your thoughts, is he likely to try and survive this thing out and run for office again?
Good
or
question.
Is he likely to step aside?
Well, I think it depends what happens next. I'm going to tell you this. The other shoe hasn't dropped yet. I really, truly believe there's more coming against Sam Page. We just haven't heard it yet. It hasn't been disclosed yet. So you remember they took his phone as part of the search warrant. The Highway Patrol took his phone. I really, and I've heard some conversations that there is more coming. So Sam Page isn't through this yet. So do I think he'll survive the next, what does he have, 14 months on his term? He may be able to push it out that far, but I do believe we've seen the end of Sam Page's reign.
Woohoo!
How about that? That's a bold prediction from Tim Fitch, and he is the treasurer for the Republican, only announced Republican candidate, Dennis Hancock, no relation, the county councilman from the 3rd District. And really appreciate your thoughts on this juvenile crime problem, because it is a problem, and it's a big chunk of the crime problem. Tim Fitch, and thank you so much, sir.
All right, talk soon.
All right, we'll hear you tomorrow on the Roundtable with Mark Reardon. We're going to step aside right now, Ethan, Sue, and I, and it is time for the quote of the day. And we're going to take that on right after this short break on News Talk, S90, whatever we are, 97.1 FM Talk. Reardon's really back tomorrow. It's John Hancock for our final few moments together. And we talked a lot about juvenile crime with Tim Fitch, former St. Louis County Police Chief. Jeanine Pirro, a pretty controversial appointee to be the U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, was confirmed with a 50-45 vote by the United States Senate the other day, and she held a news conference today, and she talked about juvenile crime, and this is our cut of the day.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Youth violence is on the rise, not just in D.C., but across the country. And if you think that these kids need to be coddled and they need to be hugged, they need to have consequences, they need to understand that enough is enough, that we're going to put them in jail or some kind of youth rehabilitation detention facility and not allow the D.C. Council, one of whom I just recently indicted, to take cover for these kids. It's time to end it. That's what the president wants. That's what we're going to do.
That's what she had to say. The governor of Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin, a guy I think a lot of, also addressed this subject of how soft on crime the Democratic Party is.
That is what soft on crime results in. When there is no consequence, then there is no rule of law. This pocket in Fairfax County where there is a Soros prosecutor, and this gentleman keeps letting people out early. We had someone who had committed a hit and run, or at least been arrested for a hit and run. He had a rap sheet a mile long, but they let him go. And 3 days later, he is caught on closed circuit TV scooping up a three-year-old toddler and trying to take her away.
Yeah, just disgusting stuff, guys.
Jeez.
And, you know, we do have a real problem in this country with these Soros-elected prosecutors. We had one here in St. Louis, Kim Gardner.
Yeah.
Now, she's gone now. But they've been very successful because most of these prosecuting local prosecutor races are relatively inexpensive. And they're electing these people, and the police on the street are maybe doing their job. But if there's nobody behind them that's removing the criminals off the street, this is a real problem in this country.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's not good. Well, so anyway, we covered a lot today, boys and girls, and it's my pleasure to be with you. I'm off to go home tonight to celebrate my father-in-law's 89th birthday.
Aw, that's really nice.
And we're doing it at home because of the horrible experience we had on his 85th birthday party.
What? Uh-oh.
So make reservation. Nice restaurant. My son flies into town. Daughter, son-in-law, granddaughter, all there. And we have reservations. We walk in, and my wife informs the waiter, it's my dad's birthday.
Aw.
And so sit down. Wonderful meal.
Ooh.
I mean, you know, I like food. I know my food. I don't know a lot about a lot of things.
but I know
a lot about food. So we're having a lovely time. Dad's regaling us with stories, you know, from the old days. And Dad's Greek. And so 100% Greek. My wife is 100%
Greek. Wow.
So we actually had a big fat Greek wedding, but that's a story for another day. So anyway, we finished dinner. Would you like dessert? Well, yes. It's, you know, it's birthday. And so we all ordered dessert. I think I had the creme brulee. And so the waiter comes out to the table with a cake in his hand and a little candle on it.
That's nice.
The candle is flickering there. And he bends over to my wife and he says, points at my father-in-law and points at me. He says, now, which one of these two is 85 years old?
I'm so sorry.
That was the biggest dent a tip has ever taken under my pen, is all I can tell you. I mean, I know I don't look like a spring chicken or anything. Well, we got to go, folks. We're out of time, but the great Jimmy Fallon's Fox Across America, that's next right here on 97.1.